playing slow, so we're playing through. Hosted by Bob Ballou and Carl Mickelson. Brought to you by the PGA Tour Superstore.
Good Saturday morning to you, Austin, Texas, and welcome inside another edition of Playing Through, brought to you by PGA Tour Superstore, right here on the Horn. I'm Bob Ballou.
Good morning. That makes me Carl Mickelson, according to the announcement, at least. Bob, we're here to talk golf. Hope you've had a good week. Has it been a golfing week of any capacity for you?
No.
I'm in the same boat.
No,
not other than a little putting, a little chipping. I don't think I've had much of a golf week whatsoever.
You did way more than I did.
Wow. Nothing was removed from the bag, huh?
No. In fact, nothing's been removed from my golf bag for a little. I think maybe once in the last couple months.
That's right. So you played two rounds and it wasn't even with your own sticks. That's right.
Yeah. I played twice last week when I was in Messina, New York, visiting my wife's family, and they actually returned tonight, the rest of the family.
Nice.
I've been here for a week holding down the fort, trying to get some work done. And it's really funny because I have this idea, this goal that I'm going to play some more golf between now and the end of the month, because at the end of September, I'm playing in a member guest. And it's with a friend of mine I always play with. And I told him, I said, I'm going to try to get some rounds in, see if I can get some work on my game, all that kind of stuff. And then I look at my schedule and I'm like, when? I have no time whatsoever to do anything. And that's like the microcosm of this year. It's just been, I just have not had a free second to do anything. And it shows in my game. When I go out and play, Carl, I have no... you don't feel like you have the control over the golf ball. You don't feel like you're obviously not as comfortable over it, but you feel like your swing's all over the place. Your putting and chipping are, you don't have the confidence that you had. It's tough. I think it's really tough when you don't play a lot of golf. And it's funny because I think to last year, how we spoke so much to, if you can just get out and go putt and chip, or if you can just get out and go hit balls once or twice a week, just keep your game in shape and all those things. And I was doing that a lot. And this year, I just haven't had any time whatsoever to do it. And I think it shows in a lot of ways in my game when I go out and play, my comfortability level when I'm out on the golf course. And even when you're playing with clubs that aren't yours and don't really feel all that great, it's still it's still that feeling of, man, where is this ball going to go when I hit it? I have no idea.
Yeah, that's a really tough feeling because, you know, there's really nothing like it. And again, we talk about our egos and our expectations when it comes to golf and our abilities. If you and I went to the basketball court, you know, we might start out stiff. Our jumpers might hit the front of the iron a couple of times, but I would say in the first 5 to 6, 7 minutes, we'd find that stroke. You know, maybe not our best form, but we'd find the rhythm, we'd find the form, and start hitting shots or getting into some sort of comfortable, familiar rhythm. Why doesn't golf have that same thing? I mean, the same thing if you go to the batting cages. I mean, you might start out a little tighter, a little pulley or whatever. And golf is just not as easy to settle back into as so many other disciplines. I mean, throwing darts any number of things. I mean,
it's funny you brought up basketball because it was the first thing that crossed my mind when we were at the Irwin Center last year after the Texas Tech game. Jeff Barker, our weekend guy at CBS Austin, we were just kind of walking through the court. And there was a ball laying out on the court. He went and grabbed it. I couldn't tell you the last time I shot a basketball at that point.
Right.
And I mean, the rim felt like it was 14 feet high instead of 10. And you're like looking at it like, what is going on? But you're right. Kind of once you settle in, it's a little easier to remember how it felt and what you're supposed to do. I'll tell you what, for me, soccer's always been like riding a bike. We played Austin FC hosted a media game last year, and I walked out on that field and it just felt natural. Like it just felt Now my touch wasn't as good, of course. But in general, you just kind of got this feeling of, okay, like I can do this. And sometimes in golf, I'll tell you what, my brother-in-law had been playing a bunch and he had gotten a new driver and a new three wood and he was hitting them great. And when I played with him, he just couldn't get off the tee. And he just kept going, I don't understand. For the last like 2 or 3 weeks, I've just been killing this driver. What is going on? And I was like, golf is going on. That's what happens in this game. And so, yeah, it's as tough as it gets. There is no rhyme or reason sometimes to why you do what you do. Look at professional golfers. Those guys are the best in the world. And you know, I've read a bunch of articles that have talked about this, about how that we don't really see the horrible shots they hit. Like it's very rare that they will. I'll never forget. Well, I don't know what tournament it was, but it was a major, and they were kind of coming down the stretch of the back nine, and they were showing all these different guys' shots, and they were just darts. Like they were just throwing darts.
Right.
And they show Matt Kuchar, who's not even in contention, and he like hooks one into the water. And it was like this most, it was the most random shot that they shot. Almost like they were going, these guys are not perfect. Here, let's just show you how.
Right.
And sure, when those guys miss, they don't miss by much, and then they recover. And you know, that's always been the difference to me, is they can hit it in the water and then get up and down for bogey. Whereas most golfers, they just like fold it, they, you know, close up shop and they make triple. But yeah, it is frustrating. And so I've got to figure out a way over the next few weeks to go play a few rounds and to get out and hit some balls and do some things to at least make it feel like I can play this game, I guess, is a good way to put it.
Mm-hmm.
It's probably not going to happen, but I've still got to try to pencil it in my calendar somewhere.
What do you look for first? I mean, as you're crawling back to the golfer that you want to be, what do you like to see first? Is it short game? Is it connecting with the driver? Is it making sure you're competent in the short iron? What's that first glimmer of hope you get when you get into the groove that you like to see? What's that process of walking it back?
For me, I think it's my driver. I think, and it's not just a, well, I've got to hit it straight and, you know, 300 yards and, you know, all those things. For me, it's just when I stand over the ball, the idea that I can get off the tee with my driver and not just be hitting it all over the place. And sometimes I think what I do in this game, and I mean, I think everybody has their glitches or hitches or whatever word you want to use. For me, it is, I get to a point where I can't swing through the ball. I get so, it's not me, it's not my own mental thinking. It's my body turns, and when I start coming back through the ball, if I'm not playing well, I will stop at impact because I just am so worried that I'm going to come over the top and hit it left, or I'm going to stay out of it and hit it way right. And so I just like kind of stab at it. Mm-hmm. And getting my body out of that, I think the biggest thing that I can do when I'm on the golf course is just slow down. Mm-hmm. I think sometimes when I start playing this, you know, when I start playing golf and I'm it's not going well, I'll just swing away. I'll get my focus just kind of goes away, and I'm just trying to get it as close to the green as I can to give myself any kind of chance to make a par or bogey. Sometimes make a double or a bogey or a double bogey.
Right.
And you just see that. And I think it's especially true of amateur golfers. When you get a little sideways, you start trying to do things you know you can't do. So let's just say, you know, you make a par to start, and then you make a double bogey, and then you make a bogey, and you're three over through three, and you've got a par five, and you hit your drive on the par five, and it goes a little right into the rough behind trees. And instead of just like, okay, I'm just going to hit a pitching wedge out to the middle of the fairway, and then I'm going to try to hit something from there. You're like, you know what? I'm going to try to cut this around the corner with a 4-iron out of the rough. And then that goes out of bounds. And then you got to, you know, play again. And then you punch, and then you drop, and then you're frustrated. And then you get to the next hole and you do the same thing where you hit one behind a tree, and instead of just punching out, you try to hit the most impossible shot through the trees. And I think that's where golf gets away from a lot of people, is you don't give yourself a chance. If you hit one bad shot and you start getting sideways, every bad shot, you think you've got to pull off a miracle shot to try to make a par. Whereas what you really need to do is just settle back in and on that par five, hit a wedge out to the middle of the fairway. Now you're laying two and you lay up to three and maybe you make bogey, make par or bogey. Mm-hmm. Well, that's going to be a heck of a lot better than a double or a triple.
That's right.
And I think amateur golfers really get outside themselves in those situations where they say, I'm in trouble. I have to pull off a miracle shot or else my day, you know, my good round is going to go away or my whatever. Now, look, sometimes if you do it fine, whatever, and maybe you pull it off. That's great. But it's just for amateur golfers, I think it's so rare. And I think you save so many strokes if your driver starts going sideways by either just pulling out a three wood or a hybrid off the tee for a couple holes, by just punching out on a couple holes. You would save yourself three, four, five shots. And by the end of the day, instead of shooting 91, you shoot 86 and you feel a little better about it. Or instead of shooting 86, you shoot 81 and you feel a little better about it.
I think there's a lot to be said for taking your medicine. I mean, I help, you know, I helped in the tiny, tiny small part when Dave Pelz wrote his book on damage control, which was literally, you know, a whole book about it. Was, you could call it course management. That's probably an oversimplification of what the book was, because it was what to do once you've hit a bad shot. I mean, the given premise of the book was you've already hit a bad shot. Damage control was the overriding theme. And a lot of it was how to. It's like, if your ball's up against a rock, do you stand backwards to it? If you're right on the downhill lip of the water. So it's really how to play really difficult shots. But it was also exactly what you said. Don't turn, you know, what's probably going to be a frustrating bogey into an eight just because you think you can hit the green from, you know, 236 behind trees, over fescue, over the edge of a ravine. That's probably not going to go well.
Right.
But his point was, is if you're second, say you hit a bad drive, you know, it goes, you know, 60% of the distance you thought it was, as long as your second shot gets you into a good angle to the green or a good angle to your landing spot if you're on a par five, and it's better than your average drive, you've really only lost about half a shot at that point. The rest is kind of up to you. If you can turn a bad swing into something that only costs you half a stroke or a full stroke, then it's a lot better than compounding the issue. Clearly, than compounding the issue, and that really started from, why are people's handicaps so high? Like, you know, the thing we talk about where people get accused of sandbagging, where a 14 handicapper goes and shoots 77 in a tournament. Well, that's possible. And then we ask ourselves, well, why, how? And you think, well, if you play with that 14, he looks like a seven half the round, but he just has two holes that he's got a couple snowmen on the card, or he's got one hole that was a nine. And it, but if you knock that out, he's only about three or four over par the rest of the holes. And you go, well, wow, I can see how this guy just doesn't really manage his game. He can hit the shots to be single digit or high single digit, you know? So it was a really fascinating process to go through that and then go through blow up holes on the PGA. That was my favorite part of my part. It was doing all the research on the really difficult days in the history of golf that before they moved to TPC Sawgrass, they used to play, it was still in Ponte Vedra, but I think it was just Ponte Vedra Country Club back when it also had an island green par three, but not, you know, not as dramatic. There was a day, like they called it Black Friday, the winds blew and the scoring average for PGA Tour players was like 77. I mean, there's guys that just couldn't get it to the hole. It was unbelievable. Then we found stats on the last two holes at Valderrama where guys could barely keep it on the green. There's that water short, you know, short and right, kind of like 11 Augusta type, but with an extreme putting surface. And guys would just go for it and just get killed, multiple shots into the water. So it's fascinating. Like you say, even pros take those extreme chances and it can bite them a lot of times, even though they're better at pulling off the shots. It's really interesting, but yeah, course management is a thing you see lack. It's funny, the more we talk to PGA Tour pros. We had the chance to sit down with Omari Resti at a meeting the other day, and he talked. This we talked about. He's like, well, I don't really want to get into giving tips because I'm not a teaching pro. But I said, Omar, you've played in 3,000 pro. I mean, I don't know how many pro ams the guys played in. You know every amateur's faults because you're sick of looking at them. You know, you could give 25 golf tips just out of frustration at this point. I mean, and he's like, yeah, you're right. People always do this and they do that. And, you know, it's really, you know, they don't even know where to put the peg in the ground on the tee box half the time. It's like, you know, if your miss is this, why would you aim yourself, you know, toward the worst case scenario that doesn't help your miss? You're just putting a peg in the ground without any thought to where your shot shape's going, what the hole on the postcard looks like. You're just not even giving yourself a chance before you even hit the ball.
Right.
It's funny to see, you know, the ideas just turn because you've all seen people just do, drive themselves off the cliff, you know, in slow motion.
I mean,
we all do. We've done it ourselves.
I was just going to say, I think we've all done it ourselves. I think that's the hard part of it. It's that's the frustrating part of golf, but it's the ability to stay within yourself and not hit those shots that cost you two more shots on a hole and then cost you another shot the next hole because you're fuming and then your game goes sideways. And then, you know, all of that is a bigger product of, I've got to take a step back and look at this shot and say, what is the most realistic thing that's going to come out of it? And, you know, I did that a couple times. When we played in Messina, the first day we played, I went 46-40, I think. Mm-hmm. And I had a couple shots that were in the rough that I was like, I'm just going to take a 4-iron and just punch it down there. And I was trying to play a little bit smart, but I also knew I was taking a little bit of a risk trying to do a little bit.
Right.
And I ended up on one of them, just instead of cutting a 4-iron, I hooked it. And it went into the, you know, really tall grass and we didn't find it. And then you drop. And then those are the mistakes.
Starts to add up. Yep.
Yeah. It just starts to add up. And then you're making an 8 instead of a 5. And now you shoot, you know, if I don't do that, I shoot 83 instead of 86. And then you start, and it just kind of compounds itself as you go on. So I think it's a great, it's a wonderful lesson for amateur golfers to remember if you're heading out to the course today, which, by the way, this really large reduction in heat down from 107 to 97 or 98 it's nice, but still you got to hydrate. I mean, it's still hot. Let's not act like it's not. So if you get out there today, make sure you do that. But yeah, it's just remember that if you're heading to the course, just remember, give yourself a chance. Don't blow up. Bucky, don't blow up. just hang in there, punch one out, you'll be fine. And we'll see kind of maybe it'll make your day a little better instead of when you get in the clubhouse afterwards, you can say, you know, I mean, I shot 83 instead of 86 and I did it because I made a couple simple adjustments.
Smart decisions. Yeah. I mean, sometimes I think you just have to trust yourself. I mean, there's a couple of courses I play where the beginning holes are just tough. I mean, it's not nice to be playing bogey golf after four holes, but you know the gettable holes are coming. So if you can just trust yourself and not try to do too much if you get out of position on those tougher holes,
right?
You know, it really makes a huge difference. I've kind of run that experiment a little bit and you know, survive the storm in a few rounds a few times. So it's been interesting to you know, I don't know if it's a maturation or an acceptance or what, or yeah, more of an acceptance that I can't, I certainly can't hit great shots all the time, but yeah, maybe sometimes I can't even hit those heroic recoveries. But I mean, I've been so historically crooked off the tee. I'm a pretty good recovery player. You know, it's the challenge is just tempering that versus what we just talked about.
Really. Yeah.
You know, putting it in a smart spot versus trying to do too much. So I can't, you know, because I can shape it. I can hit off of bad lies because I've been in so many. it's not daunting like it is for a lot of people, but
we all have.
Nevertheless, you know, we're talking about our own games and we're talking about the recreational game in general, because I think the elephant in the room is I won't speak for you, but I don't have playoff fever yet. As far as the PGA Tour goes, I'm a little starting to get fatigued about the LIV versus PGA Tour, you know, litigation. I just don't have a lot of warm and fuzzy about the pro game right now. The Ladies Open was fun to watch. I don't know if you woke up and caught much of that, but other than that, there's just not been a lot of marquee professional golf that's blown my doors off yet. I mean, I will probably get into some FedEx Cup playoff at some point. I just don't see this being the week. Kids are going back to school next week. There's a lot more to cram into the summer in these last few days. I don't know if I'm going to watch much golf this weekend.
Well, let's get into that on the other side of this break, because there is a ton to talk about when it comes to this stuff. But I think I'm going to bring up a point you just made, and I think that's going to be the one that is really going to make the most sense. And we'll do that when we come back. This is Playing Through on the Horn, brought to you by PGA Tour Superstore. We're glad you're with us on a Saturday morning. We're glad PGA Tour Superstore is a part of us. And Carl, have you been over lately? Have you gotten anything done at PGA Tour Superstore lately?
I don't know if this is embarrassing or just a sign of the times, but my side of the family, you know, you have your wife's side of the family and yours when you're married like we are, have not gotten together since Christmas. So I still have my brother, sister-in-law, and mother. I've seen my mother three or four times this year, but we haven't ceremoniously all gotten together and had Christmas. I don't know, you call that pandemic, you know, fatigue or what. I don't even remember the reason we didn't get together for Christmas, but it could have been one of the Omicrons, or who knows, whatever the reason was. Somebody was sick or somebody was incapable of getting together, so we didn't. So I actually thought I had gotten my brother's PGA Tour Superstore gift certificate, but I went ahead and got it this past week. So yeah. Long answer to a simple question, but yes, that's been my recent Superstore purchase. Which, you know, you get excited for the other person. It's like, will they go rangefinder? Are they going to get clothes? Are they going to put this on top of some other money and get a little, you know, something they've been wanting to get from the equipment side? You know, it'll be interesting. You know,
I love it.
I don't even know what I would do with, you know, with a tiny windfall of free golf store money, but I know it wouldn't be hard to spend.
No, for sure it wouldn't be hard to spend. I can always spend money. But yeah, it's another great opportunity. As we always tell you, it's a great opportunity to make your way over there, tell them Bob and Carl sent you, and they'll definitely hook you up. They have everything you need for your golf game, and we are so thrilled they're a part of our show as well. So yeah.
And take advantage of the fitting too. I see a lot of, you know, it's interesting. I talked to the people at the Veterans Golf Association. They are 16,000 strong. That means 16,000 service people actively involved in golf leagues and regional championships. And they play a national championship at Doral this year. I think they were at Pinehurst. They move around. They've been at Baltusrol Olympic Club. But long story short, of that 16,000, since the pandemic, they've grown by 6,000. And I'm hearing stories like that from organizations. National Golf Foundation. I think there's been a windfall of 6 million golfers since the pandemic. A lot of people, you know, if you look on like the subreddits in golf, every day they're asking, should I get custom fit? What's the advantage? Is it a scam? Is it scary? Are they going to hurt me? You know, any number of into the great unknown when it comes to fitting. And to me, it's been the best. It was the best thing I ever did, you know. Just to know that I'm a couple degrees upright, or to have some knowledge about chefs. You don't even really need the knowledge. Your fitter has it all and knows how to apply it. But there's really nothing better you can do for your game to shave a few strokes off and feel more comfortable over the ball is to be perfectly fit for the clubs. And the Superstore will do that with ease.
Yes, they will. They're right there at Mopac and Breaker. Make sure you get over there and tell them Bob and Carl sent you, and they will hook you up. All right, when we come back, more on Carl's favorite subject, LIV Golf.
Woo!
When we return on Playing Through, brought to you by PGA Tour Superstore, right here on the Horn. Another good Saturday morning to you, Austin, Texas. Welcome inside. back inside another edition of Playing Through, brought to you by PGA Tour Superstore. He is Carl Mickelson. I'm Bob Ballew. We probably talked way too long about our own golf games, but in that first segment, but some good discussion on what to do when to save you a couple strokes, just the golf management side of things. I'm glad we got into that. Do want to get into some live golf because it's all Carl can think about. It's all he wants to talk about. I know he is fired up for the latest rulings in the court. And
you weren't sitting next to Alan Shipnick in the court, where you weren't one of the guys that got your media company to send you to the courtroom there?
No, unfortunately I was. I don't know how Taylor Gooch, Matt Jones, and Hudson Swafford didn't prove that they'd been harmed irreparably.
Guess we're just having to paint by numbers, right? Like, okay, it's like, well, it's like we have nowhere to play. And the judge just says, well, yeah, you do. You signed these contracts to play, to do the thing you were doing over here,
right,
over there. So you're not a man without a country. So I'm having trouble finding the harm. So are we just going to go through like 50 to 100 of these situations where somebody claims they've been harmed and we just have to look at it individually like we do as parents and go, well, I know you're not happy, but that's really not harmful. Let's meet, you know.
Yeah. Listen, I think we're getting into semantics of all of it. I think, I think here's the deal. And let me start with my opinion on this. I couldn't care less, honestly, that these guys are going to play live golf.
Right.
It doesn't in any way bother me. I think originally I might have been a little bothered by it. And then I started thinking about it and I'm like, why do I care? If someone who's making $6 million a year or in their career wants to go make $100 million immediately, why do I care? I don't. Good for them. Go make money. It doesn't bother me. The other thing I started thinking about this week was, why do I care if they push back on the PGA Tour because they want to play? They're just going to make a ruling on it, and then they can either play or they can't. Doesn't really affect me either way. It's do what you want to do. If you want to try to play on both tours and see if a court will let you, fine. No big deal. But if it doesn't work out, okay, that's fine too. And the final point that I would make just on that little note is, and it's probably a point I've made before, but when Rory McIlroy says that he's going to be loyal to the PGA Tour, Justin Thomas and Billy Horschel come out with quotes about these guys being hypocrites and, you know, all the things that go into it of, well, you can't, whatever. Do you know how much money those guys have made? Do you know how easy it is to stay loyal when you've made all the money you ever need to make and you're set for the rest of your life? I would think it's a little easier to be loyal in those situations. Now, all of that said, I want to go back to a point that you made at the end of our first segment. And to me, it's the best point that I think anyone's made about any of this, which is what you said, I believe, Carl, was you're just kind of over it all.
Because there's fatigue. Yeah.
Because of the fatigue of what it's doing to the game of golf. And I think more than anything, that's what the maybe issue, I don't know if issue is the right word, but maybe the issue with a lot of this stuff is just it's starting to probably weigh on everyone. It was probably weighing on the golfers themselves for a little while. Some of them probably couldn't care less, but they're either going to stay with the PGA Tour or they're not.
Right.
But I think as a fan, some of this stuff really is going to become fatigue of every week another lawsuit, every week another a PGA Tour player ripping a live golfer or whatever it is. And the negativity that surrounds it all is what is going to be bad for the game for fans from a fan perspective.
Yeah. I feel like the fans are losing. And I think that's a little bit of the scuttlebutt on the internet. If you want to put any weight to that at all, I mean, that's a small representation of the fans is, the fear is you're going to get a diluted product now. And this is probably the time of year we can be the most critical. I mean, we've had our last exhale with the Open Championship being over. I mean, it feels like the year was just getting started. I mean, doesn't it just feel like a few days or weeks ago that Scotty Scheffler was on this tear and Sam Burns was right on his heels, and who's really having the best year? And then you have this stirring moment with Cameron Smith, winning at the Home of Golf. And, you know,
wins, and what does it immediately become? Cam Smith's leaving for LIV Golf.
Yeah, and that's really unfortunate. I mean, you look at the contrast of just those images. I mean, of a guy hoisting the claret jug at the place that means so much to so many. I mean, Bobby Jones' favorite place. I mean, the icy Ben Hogan, you know, in love with St. Andrews. I mean, Nicholas reduced to tears just talking about St. Andrews. And just the contrast of saying, yeah, I did all that, but I'm going to go play for generational money and leave all this behind. It just, it's really, I don't know if you're just going to be a fogey about it. You say, well, that's just a sign of the time. That's just, you know, young kids running away, you know, self-centered generation running away for, you know, personal gain. I don't know if it's that simple. I mean, I think for some people, it's that cut and dried. A lot of people are answering for Phil Mickelson since he's not doing a lot of media and saying, well, it's clearly about the money. It's clearly about, I think for Phil, it's about a lot more than that too. I mean, I think certainly the money is number one. It might be number one through 20 for Phil, but certainly his grudges with the way the tours run, with the way, you know, PGA Tour players have been asked to divide their time, commit their time, what they're asked to give of themselves and their schedules, is certainly at the top of his mind, how the wealth is distributed, you know, from the tour. It's interesting because there's going to be some knocks in the armor on the PGA Tour, getting it from all sides here, in terms of how much people did not know about the PGA Tour's financials and what they're going to know in the coming weeks and months.
Right.
And whether that's fair, whether it's equitable, I mean, certainly it was come about, honestly, through TV contracts and sponsorships and in any number of normal business practices. I just think to the average Joe Sixpack, that's going to look like a war chest of ridiculous money that they haven't been sharing equitably with the players. Whether that's true, whether it can be quantified one way or the other, I think the optics the PGA Tour are going to have thrust on them in the court of public opinion is going to be a very fascinating chapter in the LIV versus PGA Tour book. Again, I don't know the answer. I mean, I've heard it's anywhere that this 501, whatever, you know, I don't think they're a 501c3, but whatever the PGA Tour is in terms of their nonprofit status, apparently the argument is that they've got anywhere between $225 million in reserve, and some people are arguing that number is closer to $3 billion that they've got just to sitting on hand to knowing to do whatever they need to do with it. So again, I'm not smart enough or in a position to run the PGA Tour or anything like that. So I just think this is going to go round and round and round. I don't know if there's, you know, again, I don't know what it takes for the LIV Tour to win, because if you look at them as a product, like we would look at the NFL as a product or the NBA or even NCAA football, for spectators, I don't know how many years we're looking at before this thing approaches profitable. And I could just be shocked by the rest of the global market that's clamoring for this in countries that we don't think of top of mind. LIV has been most successful, I think, as a disruptor of the status quo of what the PGA Tour has been doing for, you know, 55 years or however long it's been. And saying, I think that's exactly the number. It's a successful disruptor, which I think puts a smile and a glint in the eye of Phil Mickelson and Greg Norman, but ultimately, is it sustainable over a long period of time?
Yeah,
I don't know. And back to the original thing I said, is it really just a diluted product for the fan? And that's the biggest concern I think a lot of people have.
Yeah, and again, what's going to happen with majors? What's going to happen with official world golf rankings points, how will this all play out for President's Cups and Ryder Cups and all those type of things, I think is such a big question for so many people. But I think you made that, you know, those points are so perfectly said. I mean, it is, in my mind, Phil Mickelson, while I know you said you think the top 20 reasons he did this are for money, and I do think a lot of the reasons he did this are for money, but I do think he had a legit beef, a legit, I want to open up the conversation to what the PGA Tour is doing. And I think whether that was his own, how much he really felt of that, how much Greg Norman persuaded him to feel that way so they could start this. Maybe they had the same type of beef because for whatever reason, I don't want to guess the reason on some of that stuff. I do wonder if Tiger Woods had never picked up a golf club and Phil Mickelson spent 1996 to 2021 as the best golfer in the world, or, you know, he was number one for all that time or whatever you want to say.
Right. Double digit.
How much, you know, if not for Tiger Woods, how much of this does Phil Mickelson feel? If not for Nick Faldo, or, you know, some of the guys in the 90s that Greg Norman could never get himself past, how much does Greg Norman really feel this way? And that is something I've wondered, is, you know, how much of this is a bitterness toward knowing how good they were and then they never really, I mean, Greg Norman was number one in the world. I'm not acting like he didn't have this spectacular career, but I've always wondered for Phil how much there was this side of bitterness of, if Tiger Woods wasn't a golfer, I would have been maybe the best to ever play, or one of the best to ever play, or how, you know, the pressure of winning the U.S. Open on the 72nd hole at Wingfoot maybe doesn't get to him because he's not thinking about those. You know, there are all these things you could go.
It's a fascinating hypothetical, but you have to look at the flip side. I mean, he would have done all those things for a hell of a lot less money over that time period of time.
Very true. It's very true.
Purses grew exponentially. They tripled purse, the annual purse allotment tripled in the first decade of the Tiger Woods effect. Yeah. It's gone exponentially from there.
And now LIV Golf has taken it to a number that I don't think anyone thought was real.
Unprecedented. Mind-blowing. Yeah.
I think the bigger part of your question, is it sustainable? It's sustainable because the Saudis that are funding this league have bazillions and bazillions of dollars. And
oh, they won't run out of money to grow at this to keep it. But how long before it's really a product? I mean, again, ROI means a lot less to them because they have so much money. But how long before it's viable? I mean, how long can you put on the, you know, the Hayes County, you know, barbecue fest, you know, and call it a world-class golf tournament, you know what I mean, where you've got, you know, literal hundreds of people, you know, going out for free bobbleheads and, you know, $3 tickets. And and again, like I say, it might be a different, it might be Formula One and some in, you know, in Qatar and in Dubai, you know, for them to see this might be a thing where they can, you know, they can sell luxury boxes and blow it out of the water, and, you know, global TV rights. I don't know. I mean, yeah, they've been doing global exhibitions like that for years, and they haven't really, you know, shaken the rafters in terms of spectators.
Right. You know? Right. And I don't, I mean, it's going to depend on the field as well. It's depend on what golfers you want to go see. And, and yeah, I think the LIV Golf field's going to be good. It's going to be a good field of good players. I mean, Cam Smith's one of the best in the game right now. And with him going, and some of the other names that are rumored that could still make the decision to turn. So you've got competing tours that have, you know.
What's the most recent surprising rumor? What's the name attached to a rumor that shocked you this past week?
Because I thought Hideki $400 million was pretty surprising a couple weeks ago.
Right, and I don't know if we've seen that substantiated either. But
we haven't.
Yeah, but I heard Cameron Young this week as well. Option, and that
all the Camerons are going
right. Anybody named Cameron has a standing invite. But somebody like that who's having success on the PGA Tour, so it sort of fits the rank and file, you know, rising young star on the PGA Tour.
So why would Cameron Young not go if they're going to offer him $100 million to go play?
Because over time,
you know what I mean. That's the hard part of this, is why wouldn't he go?
Well,
he can play another 2 years, and he's set for 4 years, and he's set for life. He doesn't ever have to play the game again if he doesn't want to.
it's that each individual's mentality.
Right. I mean, absolutely.
If you grew up dreaming of the PGA Tour, it's sort of hard to just, even though it's not hard to do the math when they're offering $100 million.
Right.
I mean, that part's simple, but if your dream was winning the Masters, winning your hometown PGA Tour event, playing where, Jack Nicklaus and Seve Ballesteros and, all the great Tom Watson, all the greats played. That's PGA Tour. That's the traditional venues. That's the traditional schedule that, every
if they take away, Carl, if they take away the majors, that's going to be where this shifts.
I think that's the big dividing line. I mean, if it becomes clear, and it might become clear as soon as this March or April, when the Masters, the Masters might be the first shoe to drop and say, well, yeah, we don't want any live guys here. Well, that's earth shattering.
It is. And I really believe, you mentioned winning your hometown event, a Scottie Scheffler wanting to win the Byron Nelson or something like that. But I don't think that's enough of a pull to get them away from that stuff.
Well, you threw the number 100 million. I think for a Cameron Young, if he thinks, if I can win, 4 million a year on tour, get another 25 million in sponsorships, if I'm really good and I'm really likable, maybe that number might be high. But you see, if I have a good 10, 12 year on tour, I'm going to get $100 million anyway.
But I think
I'm going to play in the places that I'm comfortable playing.
But it's going to take 12 years instead of four. And I think that's where, especially with younger players that like a Cameron Young who's up and coming, I think that's the hard thing of convincing them it's fine to stay. Because what if in a year Cameron Young's game falls apart and he only wins 2 million? I mean, I say only, but, he only wins 2 or 3 million and then he's given away $97 or $98 million that he could have had guaranteed. And I think setting yourself up for life for a lot of these guys is where the switch on this is. I just looked at the time. We got to take a quick break. But this is such a good conversation because it's such a good point in all of this is what is your approach I'm loyal to the PGA Tour. Well, that's great, but you may not have your card in a year and you may never play golf again after that. And I'm not saying that's like the reality. It's not a normal thing that would happen, but it is the reality of what this game is and how injuries take their effect.
That could be a career abyss for somebody. That's a real thing.
Yeah. So, okay, let's do this. Let's take a quick break. We'll have a couple of minutes when we come back to finish this conversation and see if Scottie Scheffler walks through Cameron Smith's line again. I don't know if you saw that, Carl. I thought that was pretty funny.
I did.
We'll get to that when we get back. This is Playing Through on the Horn, brought to you by PGA Tour Superstore. It's the final segment of Playing Through on the Horn, brought to you by PGA Tour Superstore. He is Carl Mickelson. I'm Bob Ballew. Big Ugly Tailgate's coming up next with Casey Stutter, Johnny Rogers, and Ashley Kamrath. They're going to get into it. We are first scrimmage for Texas football today. Steve Sarkisian going to find out a lot of things about his guys and going to start making some real serious decisions. It's not just a quarterback. It's in a lot of positions across the field. Those guys will get into that. Carl and I were just really – and we don't have the time really to – formulate our full opinion on a lot of this stuff. We never do. It's only an hour long show. But I just think the point of what does a young player do? I mean, Cameron Young has a bright future in the game.
Right.
And like you said, if he plays the next 10 years on tour, he's probably going to make $100 million in sponsorships and in winnings and all that kind of stuff. But just the idea, it's the same idea of a college football player going back to college for his senior year when he's going to be a top five draft pick in the NFL draft. Sam Bradford is a pretty good example of this, where he went back for his senior year and then hurt his shoulder and basically missed his senior year. The last injury came against Texas, and he basically missed the rest of it. And then he was still the number one overall pick, but if that injury is worse and he never plays again, it's a different story. The one that you and I will I think everyone in golf will always talk about is what Anthony Kim would have been if not for the injury. And now the question of When does his insurance policy, all the things that were always under the table, rumored, all that kind of stuff, when does that stuff get pushed aside, and when does Anthony Kim join Live Golf? And that's another big, like,
that'd be extraordinary.
It's another big thought on the PGA Tour that it's something that could happen at some point. Everybody wants that rumor to be out there because everybody wants to see Anthony Kim play golf again. I think that's the funny part of this. But all of that goes back to a guy like Cameron Young. If he gets injured, then what? And I think as we wrap up this show real quick, Carl, we can get into this again next week. But I just think it's really difficult. That's the difficult part of all of this, is life-changing money handed to you tomorrow that you know you will have over the next 4 years that will change your life forever, versus continuing to work in the game you've always worked in, and you gotta scrap and claw to make cuts every week and make sure you're making money to get to that $1 million mark this year so that you can get sponsors so that your game continues to grow.
It's a heavy decision for some of these guys, and it's a real one. It's really changed the landscape of professional golf in a short amount of time. The earth has really moved. I mean, it has. There's no doubt about it, and we just, you know, gonna have to roll with the punches week after week.
Yeah, and I know you're gonna love to continue to get into Live Golf, because I know you love the conversation. I love saying,
well,
that.
Well, it's I mean, it involves all the key players, so we have to talk about it. I mean, someone's either involved or has a strong opinion about it. So it's not gonna go away for a long amount of time. And I did want to say one thing. I mean, with the 100-degree heat and everything, and having you talked about struggles trying to get on the course, our good friend Brian Borucheski at Rock Golf hit me to something that I'm considering: a Thursday night golf league, indoor simulator golf, 5 weeks, 18 hole tournaments, 10 teams. I think they're taking total. So if you're having trouble finding time to get out and play, you know, four-hour, five-hour rounds of golf in this heat, yeah, play at night, play indoors, play with a couple beers and a relaxed environment. Do it inside at Rock Golf.
That's a great. There are a bunch of those around the area too, of places you can go to do things like that. Mm-hmm. I love that idea. That's a great one.
You know, you're still swinging. You're still doing the right fundamentals and you know, getting, you know, the immediate gratification of seeing the ball go where you made it go.
No doubt. You know, we didn't even get into David Faraday saying it's about the money. We'll talk about that again next
week.
Good for
him. Good for him to say,
for saying it, right?
To be honest like that. And that's what you needed from him.
I love it. I love it. All right, we got to get out. Big Ugly Tailgate guys are looking at us through the window like, hey, guys, let's go. Can we got to get this done. Yeah, knocking on the glass at us. We got to get out of here. Carl, always enjoy it. Let's do it again next week.
I can't wait. It's going to be fun. Thanks for the time. Thanks for indulging us for an hour. We'll do it again next week. Can't wait.
We love that you guys listen. He is Carl Mickelson. I'm Bob Ballew. This is Playing Through on the Horn, brought to you by PGA Tour Superstore. Go out and make a bunch of birdies, everyone.